This podcast covers all things health, your body, your brain, and your well-being. Each week, we'll be joined by doctors, as well as the occasional guest, to talk about the health topics that mean the most to you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm going to be discussing celiac disease. Now, as we know, celiac disease, or CD, is an immune-mediated, inflammatory, systemic disorder found in genetically susceptible people, and it's provoked by gluten, the protein found in rye, barley, and wheat. Now, this can lead to significant nutrient malabsorption and marked symptoms if undiagnosed and untreated. Now, it affects all ethnic groups and all ages, but it often comes as a surprise that 1% of the UK population has celiac disease. But a bigger kicker is that we think around 80% of this group remain undiagnosed, partly because of the wide variation in individual symptoms and signs, and also because, as we know, some people with celiac disease may be asymptomatic.
Here is a quick word from our sponsor.
We take this few seconds off to inform you, our valued loyal listener, about the best health and fitness podcast shows from the Nespod Studios. Join us as we give you the best of the best health and wellness updates you can rely on for the treatment of chronic health problems. Classic functional medicine back to basics health tips and special updates from the best doctors in the United States of America. Check out this health and wellness podcast shows. Explore Health Talk Weekly, Healthy Lifestyle Matters, Excellent Health Digest, Healthy and Free Daily, and last but not least, Weekly Health and Fitness Corner. Also, check out Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told fiction podcast, for that real life on the go experience with the 27-year-old golden boy, who made our guest invite number one list. He tells us about his story as it happens in real time and in real life. It's Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told. Go get a load of that happiness, because happiness is healthy as we know it. Join us every week as we continue to provide you the best of health and fitness wellness updates from around the globe. Enjoy the show.
As a consequence of this, there may be significant delays from celiac disease symptoms developing to the time that an accurate diagnosis is finally made. And in my experience, this can sometimes be years. Now, since 1970, the prevalence of celiac disease has slowly but progressively increased. And this is likely to be due to an increased use of diagnostic testing, as well as a better overall awareness of the importance of screening people at high risk of this condition. Now, the 2015 NG20 NICE guidelines on celiac disease were published in September 2015, but updated in early 2020 to include the Department of Health's advice on vaccination against pneumococcus for people with celiac disease. More recently, the European Society for the Study of Celiac Disease published recommendations on managing the condition and other gluten-related disorders in adults and children. And I thought I'd sort of give us a general overview on what we need to refresh our thinking about celiac disease on the back of that. And the first thing I'd say is that we should always remember that gluten ingestion can be associated with a significantly wide range of clinical disorders. So we know that celiac disease is a chronic, multigenetic, multi-organ autoimmune disorder associated mainly with HLA type DQ2 or DQ8, affecting the small bowel in people genetically predisposed to it. We also know that gluten ingestion is now being linked to a range of potential clinical conditions known collectively as gluten-related disorders. And we can subdivide celiac disease now into categories such as refractory, slow-responding, and seronegative, depending on the clinical and immunological factors present. Up to around a third of adults with celiac disease continue to have persistent symptoms, though, or signs or laboratory abnormalities despite having a gluten-free diet for at least 6 to 12 months. We also should remember dermatitis herpetiformis, the skin manifestation of CD, where you get herpetiform-like clusters of itchy papules with associated urticaria developing, along with deposits of IgA in the dermal papillae. Now, these do usually slowly clear once gluten's withdrawn from the diet, although there may be cases where it remains despite that occurring. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity causes irritable bowel-like syndrome-type symptoms that develop hours or days after the ingestion of food containing gluten. But those symptoms rapidly improve on gluten withdrawal and relapse after a gluten challenge. Less commonly, gluten ataxia is a sporadic ataxia in association with a positive celiac serology. And celiac disease can also be linked to other disorders, including peripheral neuropathy, epilepsy, depression, and even dementia. Now, who should we be testing for celiac disease? Well, the recent European Society guidelines strongly recommend that anyone with symptoms, signs, or laboratory evidence suggesting malabsorption should be serologically tested for celiac. And the screening of asymptomatic first-degree relatives of a patient with CD is also recommended. So looking at the groups of people we perhaps should be offering testing to, then I'd be thinking of things like unexplained prolonged fatigue, persistent unexplained gastrointestinal symptoms, and these are often attributed to irritable bowel, by the way, poor growth, unexpected weight loss, persistent oral ulceration, unexplained B12, folate, or iron deficiency, and anyone with type 1 diabetes and autoimmune thyroid disease, both at diagnosis and at regular intervals from then. We should also consider serological testing for anyone with a metabolic bone disorder, anyone with unexplained and persistently raised liver enzymes, females with unexplained subfertility or recurrent miscarriages, and in Downs or Turner syndrome. So when considering the diagnosis, serological testing is the gold standard, the preferred single test to detect celiac disease at any age is the IgA transglutaminase 2 antibody test, or IgA-TG2. And this should be undertaken in laboratories with clinical pathology or ISO accreditation. Now, the lab should first test for total IgA-TG2 as the first choice of test and use endomysial antibody testing, IgA-EMA, if these are weakly positive. Now, any diagnostic serological tests should always be done while the patient is on a gluten-containing diet. And in young people and adults, a positive serological test result is defined either as an unambiguously positive IgA test alone or a weakly positive IgA but a positive IgA-EMA test. So the confirmation of celiac disease as a diagnosis should always be based on three things: clinical findings, positive serology, and duodenal histology, because positive serology plus villus atrophy is diagnostic confirmation. I think it's very important to remind ourselves that improvement or exacerbation of symptoms after gluten withdrawal or reintroduction actually has a very low predictive value. And so that should not be used to make a diagnosis of celiac in the absence of other supportive evidence. Now, if we get a patient who has negative serological testing, but you still suspect celiac disease as a diagnosis, then refer to your local gastroenterology specialist for further assessment. We should also be telling our patients that any test for celiac is only accurate if a gluten-containing diet is eaten during the diagnostic process, and that they shouldn't start a gluten-free diet, however tempting it is, until their diagnosis has been confirmed by a specialist, even if their serological tests are positive. A really, really important point. And they should also aim to eat some gluten in more than one meal each day for at least 6 weeks before being tested. Now, if we do have a patient who is reluctant to eat gluten before being tested, and we do get that for understandable reasons, then just refer that patient to a gastroenterologist, but do explain to them it may be more difficult to confirm the diagnosis by intestinal biopsy. So, obviously, young people and adults with positive CD serology should always be referred to a gastroenterologist for endoscopic intestinal biopsy to confirm or exclude the diagnosis, and that should go without saying. But serological testing should not be performed to simply determine if gluten has been excluded from an individual's diet. And if we're talking about diet, we must remember treatment with a lifelong, strict, gluten-free diet is currently the only known effective treatment for celiac disease. Full stop. Patients should be educated to avoid any cereal or food product derived from wheat, barley, or rye, including gluten-contaminated cereal foodstuffs that are normally gluten-free, and that can include things like oats and maize. However, oats that are uncontaminated by gluten are very safe for almost all patients with celiac disease, although there may be a very small percentage who remain sensitive to them and who develop symptoms if ingested. Referral of our patients to national and local specialist celiac organizations and to dietitians with specialist knowledge of celiac disease is always helpful, and that should be something we should always be doing as a matter of routine. We must also remember that micronutrient deficiencies are common in celiac disease, and not only that, we should be testing for them on diagnosis. So any patient with a new diagnosis of celiac should be tested to check for deficiencies in essential micronutrients. And of course, we mustn't forget that a gluten-free diet itself has some nutrient limitations. About 4 out of 5 patients with celiac will have an iron deficiency at diagnosis. And in fact, celiac is present in about 5% of people with all iron deficiency anemias. But this does improve on a strict gluten-free diet, as does vitamin B12 deficiency, found in just over a third of cases of untreated celiac. Now, malabsorption linked to celiac also often leads to an inadequate intake of calcium, vitamin B6, and vitamin D, and around a quarter of patients with celiac have osteoporosis of the lumbar spine, compared with about 5% of matched controls. However, vitamin D and calcium levels do usually normalize within 2 years of following a strict gluten-free diet, but these should be supplemented in patients with celiac and low serum levels of these, or those with loss of bone mineral density, or those who can't achieve an adequate intake via diet for whatever reason. You should not need long-term supplementation with zinc, because zinc deficiency can be present, but this does usually resolve completely on a strict gluten-free diet. Now, finally, we mustn't forget the importance of longer-term follow-up. All patients diagnosed with celiac should be encouraged to join national celiac societies or support groups, as I mentioned. And in the first year following diagnosis, follow-up should occur regularly in order to monitor dietary adherence, to provide psychological support, and to answer any questions that the patient may have. Now, once celiac's been stabilized and dietary alterations have become routine for that patient, then either annual or biannual follow-up is advised, along with checks for things like thyroid disorders and liver disease, and antibody checks to assess dietary adherence. The key endpoint here that we're aiming for is the absence of any symptoms and full mucosal healing. So it's entirely reasonable to do a follow-up biopsy in adults 1 to 2 years after starting a strict gluten-free diet to assess that, especially in those patients who initially presented with severe symptoms or in those aged 40 and above. So I do hope you found that overview of celiac disease helpful and as a reminder about what we should be doing in practice as a matter of routine.
This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you. This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you.